Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
今週のレトロナッツ日本
オス
漫才
Hola, everyone, and welcome to the Japanese episode of Retronauts. I'm Jeremy Parrish, the host of this episode, episode 10 of Retronauts, volume 3, and I'm here in Tokyo at Scenic 84 Towers with a gaggle of people. My God, how did we fit all these people in here? This tiny
office.
It's
getting hot in here.
Japan.
It is getting hot in here. No, never mind. So, hey, everyone, let's introduce ourselves because we don't have much time and we got to make this awesome thing happen.
Okay, I am Mark McDonald
of H4, and this is Shane
Bettenhausen.
PlayStation, formerly of the old Retronauts.
I didn't think you were allowed on podcasts anymore.
I got to re-break my cherry on the H4 the other day.
Wow.
Unchained.
Saucy.
Unchained.
Unchained.
Kat Bailey, intrepid freelancer.
This is John Riccardi from H4.
This is gaming fashionista Kyle McLean.
Nice.
And my name is Daniel Fight. I'm a freelancer. I live here in Japan.
And Daniel Fight is the reason this episode is happening, because Dan was one of our Retronauts Kickstarter backers who supported the podcast at the co-host an episode level. And he did that without thinking he would ever have the opportunity. But I said, no, I'm going to be in Japan and I'm going to make you come on the show.
Yes, kids, follow your dreams and you too can pay money and go on your favorite restaurant.
So is this where Dan takes over? He just grabs your laptop from you and then is like, I paid for this.
This is my show now.
Yeah, we're talking about Sega Master System for the next 50 minutes.
Sweet, I can do that.
Sit down and shut up.
Neo Geo.
I'll be all right.
We are not going to talk about Sega Master System unless that is what you choose to talk about. Because this episode, being Retronauts in Japan, we're going to talk about the golden age of Japanese gaming. But that's a very subjective claim. And I would not presume to impose on you my opinion of what the golden age of Japanese gaming is.
Mm.
So I'd like for each of you to make a case. Tell me what you think the golden age of Japanese games was. And I'm talking like an era of, say, 3 years. You have to make it count. If you just say like, oh, you know, the 90s. No, that's lazy and cheap. You can't do that.
Is it okay if we all end up agreeing?
I don't think we're going to.
There's a correct answer, and then there's all your opinions.
I know that there are multiple answers. And you know, even though this is Retronauts, if you happen to think, John Riccardi, that today is the golden age of Japanese gaming because you can play Monster Hunter 4.
That'd be a twist answer. That'd be a surprise
Shocker.
Answer.
I'm going to allow it.
Really? You're not going to kick me out of my own office?
I couldn't do that. Against the law.
Should we just
it's
get
domain.
1998 or whatever out of the way? Like, is somebody going to throw that?
I'm throwing it out right now.
Okay,
1997 to 2000. Let's go.
That's 4 years.
Oh, come on. 2000. All right. 1997 to 1999.
Okay. Kat Bailey, tell us why you think that was the golden age of Japanese gaming. Man, this is kind of like a Japanese gaming show, actually. I'm doing the cheesy voice. Do it.
Nothing was bigger than Japanese games in 1997. Nothing was bigger than Final Fantasy. The PlayStation owned everything.
Metal Gear
Solid came out in 1999.
Symphony of the Night.
No, 1998.
97 and 98.
97, 98.
Yeah.
Well, Zelda went 3D.
Ocarina of Time.
It feels like a very long time ago now, but it was also an era where video games as we know them were maturing. They were no longer just for kids. It was okay for college students and even adults to start buying and owning systems like the PlayStation. And Japanese games were at the forefront of that. I would say
I would say actually PlayStation helped make it cool for people to own video game systems because the advertising for that platform was focused around older people. It wasn't necessarily about kids. It wasn't like, hey, you're gonna have a crazy monkey adventure.
Pretty loud, Club. Kids. Like,
old people like Polygon Headman, things like that.
Yeah. Polygon Man.
Some of the initial advertising, not so good. But after a while, they kind of settled down and were like, hey, maybe we should be sane and just communicate the idea that this is cool and futuristic and not like a bunch of little fuzzy puppies.
Well, here in Japan, too, PlayStation 1 was the system that basically got women out and about and into gaming, because like that is the probably number one most popular system with women, female gamers in Japan, for whatever reason. Probably
DS?
No, well, I'm talking about in that era, like we're talking about. Basically, that was the one that sort of brought it out from being just like a dorky dudes thing to like everybody can play games and enjoy them. It was Parappa the Rapper. It was a lot of
Crash
those kind
Bandicoot.
Of Crash Bandicoot, those sort of cutesy, cool games.
It was because, what was her face? Her name? Sonia?
Sonia with a whip.
Yeah, she could kick your ass and take your name. She was a tough lady.
Sure.
I also think PS1...
Women felt empowered.
PS1 like was, you know, in some ways better than the arcade games. You got longer, deeper experiences with cool CG cutscenes. Like, it really feels... You felt like you were on the cutting edge when you bought those new games in a way it didn't a generation before.
And lest we forget, 1998, Pokemon exploded into the world, and...
Well, actually,
your side of the world.
Yes, it did come out here in 1996, but it exploded into the world in 98, 99.
True.
And it's hard to fathom just what a phenomenon Pokemon was. I don't think we've ever really seen the like before or since. Maybe Mario in the 80s.
Well, what are you using as your definition for something?
It was
like
mainstream
that?
To the point that everybody could recognize Pikachu. It was not just a gaming thing. It wasn't even a casual gaming thing. Okay. It was a thing where
you can go to any
my dad could recognize Pikachu.
Right.
No, you know? I disagree. I mean, Pokemon definitely was the biggest thing in the 90s, but before that, I mean, I remember when Mario came out and said, I'm more popular than Jesus, and remember how controversial that was?
That was pretty controversial, wasn't it?
Super Mario Brothers 3 commercial, like, that was really incendiary.
I'm bigger than Jesus!
Luigi on the cross.
Is Pikachu the only video game character to be in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade?
Oh, Sonic.
Sonic.
Are Angry Birds not in that, like, every year
Pikachu
now?
Pikachu was in the Macy's Day Parade.
There's like just a bunch of boxes that they kick down the street and they're like, look, kids, Minecraft.
Well, I also feel like during that time, a lot of the classic Japanese third parties like Square, Capcom, Konami were still doing really cool stuff, top of their game.
Our favorite creators were definitely at the top of their game. I mean, you look at Kojima.
I will say, though, that I'm going to disagree because as great as those years were, you had a dark cloud on the horizon in the form of Half-Life, which changed video gaming in a way that... Japan still hasn't really, like, I don't know, they've never really chosen to take on that style of interface and presentation. But also, the 32-bit era was really, really brutal on a lot of the smaller Japanese developers. Like, there are so many people who, you know, like, smaller companies that sort of made their name in the Famicom, Super Famicom era, and then just, you know, Genesis, Mega Drive, whatever, and then just kind of withered away. Like, they couldn't cope with the jump into
like
the third dimension.
For example.
So as much as things like Final Fantasy VII and Resident Evil were ascendant, like the kind of really great B-tier games that made gaming so interesting before, like they still happened on PlayStation, but you could see like they were starting to fade away.
At the same time,
have more trouble to find a place.
While I agree with that to an extent, the PlayStation also offered a great deal more freedom to developers because they weren't bound by all the licensing restrictions that Nintendo brought to the table.
You know, the more I think about it, that the Half-Life example actually made me think one interesting thing about that era, right about the turn of the century, was that Japan...
Millennium,
was that Japan was... like top of the world is in terms of like branding and mind share, had the characters, had the Mario and the Pikachu and stuff like that, technically was pushing the envelope more than anyone else, which Japan still does okay at from time to time. But to your point about Half-Life at that time, with things like Metal Gear and to some extent even like Resident Evil, was actually at the forforefront of storytelling. Metal Gear Solid was pushing the envelope in terms of storytelling, and like
just amazing.
Final Fantasies were pushing the envelope in terms of storytelling, and that's something that Japan has
sick.
Completely lost. Even with the series that are still popular, people are even, you know, shrug their shoulders at Final Fantasy stories. Monster Hunter, which is popular here, is not really for the story that people play that for. Japan has completely lost the message in terms of pushing narrative.
But has have Western games really done much to push video game narratives. I mean, you had Half-Life with the immersion, and then that kind of reached its ultimate Hollywood expression with, you know, Modern Warfare.
Like dialogue
that's
trees.
That's kind of been, like, well, okay,
PC-style
sure,
dialogue
sure,
trees yeah. infiltrated console games.
You look at the way indie developers are starting to play around with narrative, and, I mean, you look at a game like Journey or even a game like Hotline Miami, where it's not about the graphics necessarily. It's using all of the different tricks of interactivity to really put you in the mood.
It's kind of saying, as much as it is being pushed, it's not happening in Japan. Like, games like Last of Us and stuff like that aren't coming out of Japan. I mean, you do have an exception, like an Ico or a Nico, a Shadow of the Colossus, that does actually do really interesting storytelling, but it's almost like the exception that proves the rule.
Sure.
And those well, come out.
But, you know, I feel like there hasn't been actual strong innovation in terms of storytelling in a long time. Well, like, we've kind of hit a wall. So
keep
people
in mind,
are just spending more money to make something more movie-like.
But you've got your you were talking about the PlayStation era, though, right? And how like that was sort of, if you think about it, the PlayStation era, or maybe like partway through the PS2 era, was sort of where this often talked about like decline of Japan started to occur, right? And I think a lot of that is the fact that games became so expensive that the managers and stuff above, you know, the suits at these companies could no longer just let these creators just go off, you know, and do whatever they wanted to do and make whatever crazy things they wanted to make. And that's where innovation sort of dropped.
Well, there was a flip in terms of production costs and expenses in game development at that point. Actually, making 8-bit and 16-bit games was not that expensive, mm-hmm. but the production, the cost of the cartridges was really, really high.
That's true.
And all of a sudden, with the advent of CD-ROMs and, you know, greater storage and cheaper media, video game production became extremely cheap in terms of manufacturing. But, you know, pushing better graphics and higher spec content, that made the actual upfront cost of development
higher. Right.
So it became more, you know, incumbent on developers and less on publishers at that point. And there was like this change, I think, in the sort of the power relationship between those two, you know, those two facets of the business.
Totally. My final 2 points. In 1999, we got the Dreamcast, which...
98 in Japan.
So my apologies. I mean,
in Japan.
Look,
I'm just saying that it's even sooner than you were giving it credit for.
Well, I suppose what I'm kind of saying is that if we're talking about this three-year period, I'm also talking globally.
Mm-hmm.
But the Dreamcast, as much as it might not have truly reached its potential, it was a really great console. And, I mean, it was the last hurrah of Sega.
Was out around then. Neo Geo Pocket right. Color.
And in 1999.
Okay, I will not give you Neo Geo or Game.com. I will give you Neo Geo Pocket.
I feel the Dreamcast has a tragic ending, whereas Saturn was like, you know, Sega growing as a platform holder in Japan. Saturn did really well here.
But at the same time, Americans outside of a certain niche never really understood how great the Sega Saturn really was.
True.
Because, I mean...
Well, Sega made sure of that.
If you
I'm not sure it was America's fault. I might have had something to do with it.
Yeah, stupid Americans, you don't understand how great the system that you never got any good games for.
I'm not saying... I'm saying that it's not their fault. It's definitely not their fault because of Sega, but...
Yeah, well, maybe just to pull it back to the original question, let me throw something else out there that's not necessarily my opinion, because I'd have to think long and hard about a three-year period, but I think somebody could make a case for the years surrounding like 1991.
That's my choice.
The move into 16-bit, you still had 8-bit, like some of the strongest 8-bit games. Arcades, Japan was still really...
So lock it down. Which 3 years?
Well, I say 89. I say 88 through
92. Hold on, you're encroaching into my turf.
88 through 92.
Start with 89-ish. Because
you got Link to the Past, you have the first...
Shane, that's not 3 years. You're breaking the rule.
Okay, 89 to 91. If we're talking about Link to the Past,
Genesis,
that was 1991.
Genesis was doing really well at that time.
See, you're leaving out PC Engine. I think it's about Mega Drive, PC Engine, and Super Famicom.
You're talking about...
That era.
You're talking about like a 6 year era, Shane.
There's a point where
again, you're pulling off more here than you're allowed.
I'm two
over.
People, damn it. Shane Bentenhausen.
There's a point when all three
but
of
let's
those
not let's not forget arcades. Like arcades used to matter and mm-hmm. used to mean something, and like, you know, trips to Japan used to also be really cool and exciting because you would see stuff that was going on in arcades here that we were not getting in America.
Wait, you're not excited about like these networked Gundam games that are completely...
Card battle games. I mean, don't get me wrong. I bring my cards to Akihabara like everybody else.
Derby games. Yeah.
But yeah, and Corn Metal
Extreme
games.
Gundam Extreme
Versus
is the best.
Big into that
shit. I've got my entire wallet of Lord of Vermillion cards, damn it.
There's still a lot of innovation in Japanese arcades, like the flip the table game.
Oh, yeah, that's fantastic.
And stick the giant finger in the butt game.
Yeah.
Milk the cow game.
Well, we should keep talking about this era that Mark brought up.
Stick the finger in the butt game. That's from Cat's era, actually. Babunga Bunga. And wasn't that Korean?
Korean.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's...
Now,
that was
right.
That was like 98, 99.
Yeah. Here's what I'm wondering about arcades circa 1990-91 in Japan. Now, in... The U.S., arcades were really declining already by 1991. Were they doing the same in Japan, or were they still really at the top of their game?
The fighting game thing was going strong, and they were really big.
Oh, that was like 92, right?
No, but it was still in like 93, 94, like Neo Geo was going on.
Kind of a decline in the mid to late 80s.
Virtua Fighter was coming.
And then, you know, the kind of walk and punch brawl games, Double Dragon.
Conveyor belt action.
Yeah, like that kind of picked things up a little bit, but then Street Fighter 2 really... Like that revival.
Remember, the real thing that the real reason in America that arcades declined was because they essentially became drug hangouts. They were like places where quote unquote bad people went. They were.
You like turned into my dad or something? Really like, dude, what are you talking about?
Totally,
like,
dude. Totally.
John, your arcades were a lot cooler than
the arcades, as much as they were drug hangouts, were always drug hangouts, though. It didn't turn into that.
No, no. My point, though, is that never happened in Japan, which is why Japan didn't have the same kind of decline that we had. One of the reasons, ask anybody why arcades closed in the 90s, was because they became places that were. In New York, we had all of our arcades like were closed because of drugs.
You're living in a different place than me.
Was this RoboCop 2? Because there was a really bad arcade.
But you lived in New York. You know what I'm talking about, don't you?
I lived in a small town in New York. My arcade was a small card shop. It was very wholesome.
Are you talking about the Chinatown arcade, basically?
No, I'm really serious. Like every there were like maybe 6 or 7 arcades in my neighborhood when I first grew up. Like they had like, you know,
there's
all
a movie called Joysticks, John, that I can introduce you to. That's from the early 80s, and it was the image of arcades even then was like that's where the degenerate losers were. And that, not
well,
that
if you
that
really don't
wrong.
Know this, I think it's worth talking about then because it was wrong.
That is where the degenerate losers were hanging out, and people like us. I think the decline of arcades happened after
my local arcade got closed because some guy on drugs drove a truck through the front glass.
Yay!
Okay, well, that was the reason for your one, but just as that was not the reason for decline of arcades overall,
you can't extrapolate that into an entire country.
It was the rise of the home consoles overtaking to a large extent,
arcades
remain
strong in Japan, and I think, you know, a lot of it boils down to the same reasons that certain things thrive in Japan and not in America, because America is so big, so spread out. Mm-hmm. It's not centralized around these big cities, like a few big cities like Japan and even like the UK.
Yeah.
I know nothing about the UK's arcade scene.
I don't either, but I'm sure like they love shmups. They talk about shmups a lot.
I really feel like the 16-bit era, because of what had come before, because of NES, we all grew up playing Nintendo, and we felt like Nintendo 8-bit, like, you know, reconfirmed what we loved about games. And then suddenly there was, you know, 3 platform holders in Japan that were all viable, which is we didn't have in America.
Well, and there was
wasn't that viable here.
Mega Drive was viable.
It
not
was,
as much as
not
Genesis.
Japan.
But
not
as much as Genesis.
Not
but enough
all.
To hang on for like 6 years and still have good games coming
just
out
Sega's
in the other territories.
That wasn't the American money.
In the other territories.
Yeah, you only heard about the Mega Drive because everybody was excited about it in the other countries.
To Shane's point, I think a really cool, interesting thing about that era, as much as I don't know that people have it figured out now, but at that time, people didn't have anything figured out as far as like system transitions and stuff. It was just a weird era, like odd hardware choices, especially PC Engine.
Arcade
just
card,
that to me, I still really am fond of, and that kind of represents a nice nostalgia for me, just around these weird kind of half steps and mistakes and weird
super graphics.
Exactly. Right.
So, Mark, did you nail down 3 years specifically, not Shane's 6 years?
Well, I'd have to think about what was Mario 3 89?
Mario 3 was 88.
88. Okay, so it's like the 1 year. But I would say like 89 to 92, if I had to choose.
That's
3 years,
still
maybe.
4 years.
Damn it. Thought I'd get away with that. No, and that's not even, I just wanted to throw that out as a discussion topic. I really honestly don't know what my golden era would be.
Well, I think.
That's when I started importing games, at least.
You started talking about a really, like when you mentioned Super Nintendo and Link to the Past and everything, to me, that is essentially like the early 90s, the very late 80s and the early 90s. And that was like a super important era. But like, for me, it's like slightly before that, basically. Like, 1987 was, I think, what younger people think of like 1998 as. Basically, you had Metroid, you had Kid Icarus, you had like, Zelda 2, you had even Super Mario, I guess, 3, like all between
and
97
the free
and 98.
Snail game in the Master System. Not
hey, Phantasy Star.
What's up?
Yeah, all these like Alf. Basically genre defining games, like they basically, a bunch of genres were born in like those 18 months. Like all these different amazing games came out in that time period. And I really think that set the stage. It's hard to argue that they were better than their Super Nintendo incarnation, because they weren't. So that's why I think Mark's era is like more appealing to me, like as a gamer. But as far as influence in the industry, those 3 years were super key.
John, I'm pretty much with you there. I'm actually going to go slightly earlier. I'm going to say 1985 through 1987. In those years, you have Super Mario Brothers. You have really great arcade games like Ghosts and Goblins. You have the advent of the Famicom Disk System. So you get deeper games like Zelda, Metroid. You know, on the PC side, you were starting to see companies
like...
The
Famicom disk system really wasn't that successful, though.
No, but it was cool.
But it was cool.
I'm not talking about the system itself. I'm talking about the things that resulted from that. The games that were created because of the new opportunities that that technology offered.
It
married the flexibility of PC software with the accessibility of consoles. So all of a sudden you had these like computer-style RPGs that had this, you know, like a classic console game front-end, very simple, very accessible... And that's where you got things like Zelda.
Cool thing about
the way through Dragon Quest, Final Fantasy. I mean,
yeah.
And then, you know, you had the PC Engine launch.
Yeah. A cool thing about that era, too, in Japan, too, even just looking back at the magazines, was that it was also new, right? I mean, it had been around here for a few years, but that was when it was really just blossoming and exploding into, like, pop culture. And so it was just like, what's this crazy cool new thing that all the kids are doing?
That's also the point at which
Master Higgins. I mean,
America had gone into kind of a moribund state for its console industry, but at that point you had Nintendo make inroads into the global market and really kind of revitalize and define video games outside of
Japan. And we're recording this in the wake of Yamauchi's passing, so you know it is kind of like relevant that like you know that he did change everything. The NES changed the entire industry.
Plus, right. If you look back, or if you look at Japan especially, it seems like so many people just have an incredible amount of nostalgia for that particular era in a way that they don't have nostalgia for anything
else. There's a TV show about it called Game Center CX this comedian just plays games from that era mostly and does a horrible job of it, and it's hilarious and awesome, but it's also very nostalgic.
Games you can actually go back and still enjoy, whereas like Golden Age, 2600, you know, late 70s stuff, it's kind of hard to go back, whereas you can still go back to the 80s and have fun.
That's true.
You know, at that point, I don't think most of us knew that, hey, these video games that we're playing are from Japan. They were just these amazing video games from a company with a weird name.
We started to figure it out,
I still remember.
I figured out the day
I got the NES when I asked my mom, what's Nintendo mean? She goes, oh, that's from Japan. And I started to study Japanese the next day.
Your mom was smart.
I was totally oblivious to
that was the truth. She said China, right?
she said Japan. Wow.
I still remember. I think it was the first issue of Next Generation magazine when I discovered that the guy who made Mario was the same guy who made Zelda. And I was just like, my mind exploded, but at the same time, like everything made sense.
Right.
It was just like, this is ridiculous. Like the same guy made these two things was so incredible to me.
Within a year of each other too.
Right. Yeah, I mean, both of those were meant to sort of define the platforms they were on. And he really sat down with his team and said, what is the ultimate cartridge game that we can create? And that was Super Mario Brothers. And then he said, what can we do with the flexibility to have, you know, more capacity and rewritable save files?
I have a theory that Zelda 1 was originally meant to be a cartridge. I don't know. Someone's probably
done
the homework on
this.
That's
what he's said in, like, Iwata Asks.
I recently unearthed a couple of screenshots from Zelda 1 that I'm pretty sure have never been out.
John's done his own research that proves that Miyamoto is lying about this situation.
Miyamoto also trying to, like, say Zelda 2 wasn't a good game.
Yeah, that's true. Fuck that guy.
Fuck that
guy.
He didn't say it was a bad game.
No.
I know. It was slightly out of context.
But he's got more disappointing games, but he's got way more disappointing games.
He made music, okay.
Yes, that's an easy one.
I like Devil World.
That never got released in America because of, you know, we were scared of the devils.
Yeah, they couldn't call it Monster World.
But I found these old screenshots of Zelda, and this is super technical and anal, but this is Retronauts, so I think it's suitable. But like the font that was used in these beta screenshots was the NES font, not the disc
fact.
Font, which are different fonts.
Yes.
Which says
fact.
To me,
yeah, that says to you,
either
but
they changed the font very late in the cycle, which is possible,
likely.
Or it was originally a cartridge.
I think it's probably more likely
that
they changed
the font. Think about it. What did it do that you couldn't do on a cartridge other than be bigger?
Well, they had more space.
And they even said they made the whole second quest because they figured out they had all this extra space.
Right. Old NES games before the Famicom Disk System, even though they were Japanese, they just had English text. When the Famicom Disk System came along, they had a little more space so they could start to put, you know, Japanese alphabets in there.
Can I
that's probably something that came further into the development.
Right. Let me ask a question to everyone that might inform what particular people's answers are. I think it'd be interesting to see if this correlates or whatever. But what year and what game was the first Japanese game that anybody here imported?
Imported.
Played the Japanese version of
My first game was 1990, I want to say, 6, and it was a Ranma 1/2.
That was 1997.
It was a Super Famicom game.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Along with that, Giv, what would your 3-year period be?
3-year? Oh, man, I could make a legitimate argument for anywhere from like 1985 8 to about 1990.
We could all do that, but we're all here choosing a 3-year period.
Like what they just said, the transition into the 16-bit era, when all the rules about what this industry is were being written right before our eyes, which is so...
Jeremy, people who have already chimed in with their 3 years, I'm curious what your guys and Kat...
I've already stated my years, 1985.
No, but I mean, yes, people who've chimed in, what was the first...
Oh, for the import.
Yeah.
My first import was Castlevania, Akumajo Dracula X...
PC Engine.
Nocturne and the Moonlight. It was Castlevania of the Night.
PS1.
Wow.
I did, like I said, I was kind of oblivious to the Japanese thing, and I didn't realize you could buy games from another country. And then I saw a demo for, like, a video trailer for Symphony of the Night and heard, this game may not be coming to America. And I said, no, I have to have this.
It's so where I stand.
I went and this... This lack of importing will not stand. I went and had my PlayStation modded. I bought Symphony of the Night. It cost like $150, and it was so worth it. I played that game so much.
So worth it.
Altogether, I mean, like the whole process.
Okay. I have two. So if importing from Canada is allowed, then Zelda 2 came out a month beforehand.
Canada is a lot like Japan. Everyone's very friendly.
Canadian version of Zelda 2 at my local rental shop. Actually, none of these, I didn't buy them. I rented them because I was blessed to like grow up next to a rental shop that rented import games. But Rockman 2 and Super Mario 3. When they were new. Like I had Mario 3 a year before it came out in the U.S.
Was there really that big a gap in Rockman 2, though?
No, Rockman 2, I just rented it. Like, this game was cool, and then I took it home. Wait, it's Mega Man 2.
You had a nice
and you were like,
store.
This doesn't have really gross, horrible artwork on the cover. It must be great.
When I was living in Japan in 2006, Pokemon Diamond and Pearl came out. And I was gonna wait until the English version came out, but I decided to walk to the store and buy Pokemon Pearl. And
is it really an import if you walk to the store and buy
it?
It
was a Japanese game.
But that was the first one.
You're very patient.
I had never
yourself to Japan. That's more.
Okay. Right. I mean, I never modded my consoles or anything.
I see.
And went out and imported the game. So I guess I'm kind of a nerd around here. I'm not nearly as hardcore as anybody else.
Is it nerdy if you're like...
Yeah, I think you're less
normal?
Of a nerd, I think, actually.
It's the inverse here of Retronauts.
Well, my working theory, and I was wondering if it seems like it's maybe only true for me and John and maybe Shane, but I was wondering if it was like, who's the comedian who's like the music you lose your virginity to, you'll love the rest of your life? Like, that's the music you'll love. I was wondering if all of our golden eras would coordinate along with roughly when we started actually playing the games.
Nope.
But it sounds like it's not necessarily the case.
One thing that I find interesting, you said that the 16-bit era was your golden era. For me, for me personally, it was not that good an era because I never owned a Super Nintendo at that time or a Sega Genesis because my parents wouldn't get me one and I was a poor kid. So I don't have the same attachment to that era, even though I really wanted to. And that makes me kind of realize at the same time, a lot of kids like my age who grew up with the NES in the late 80s moved on from video games in the 90s because the Super Nintendo came out and their parents wouldn't get it to them. Yeah. The market fragmented.
I had several friends like that stopped playing after NES.
Sure. Lapsed gamers.
At that time.
Yeah, I'm actually kind of one of those.
Yeah.
And at that time, the video game industry went through a very painful change. It started... A painful maturity started to come along until 1997 when it kind of emerged from that. It's as an beautiful butterfly.
You know, I have a lot of affection for the Super NES because the very first summer job that I had, I used my first paycheck to buy a Super NES and it was amazing. I love that system. But at the same time, as a historian, like as someone who, that sounds pretentious, as someone who's
historian.
Spent a lot of time reading and writing about video game history, I just feel like the period I named 1985, 86, 87 was when the rules, like the real rules, were being written.
That's
like,
why it's hard.
Video games were being invented then.
That's why it's hard to choose, at least for me, because there's like your personal, and then there's also like the historically significant.
The 16-bit era was amazing. There were so many great games, but they were refinement. It was the 8-bit era and the 32-bit era where invention happened and people said, how do we make these things work? And 16-bit, and then, after that, after 32-bit.
But at the same time,
how do we make these things better?
Yeah, that's true.
One thing that was really great, though, about that era, too, you talked earlier about the transition into, you know, from cartridges and having these limitations to, like, CDs and everything and having no limitations. I feel like limitations were better for us as far as quality of games, because when you were forced to create something within a limited environment, you were forced to be creative. Whereas once CDs came out, it was like, oh, we can just throw in 50 hours of CG.
That's what applies to all art, I think.
This is why I like console games so much more than PC games, because PCs are theoretically without limit. You know, you can make something for a spec that's going to come along 3 years later, but with a console, you have these harsh limitations, and if you work within those boundaries, you can create greatness that,
and also
you know,
PC,
that you wouldn't necessarily get
a different
otherwise.
Experience if you had a different graphics card or something. Mm-hmm. You know,
the funny thing about the mid-80s, like the 8-bit era and the 32-bit era, there was so much garbage at that time because you had all these fly-by-night developers coming in and saying, I'm going to make a quick buck on a video game.
Yep. You didn't like LG.
Same as it ever was.
I mean, that's not any different than any other era.
Look at the Wii.
The Atari 2600 era died because of that.
Oh, yeah.
The Wii era, the DS. Every platform, every generation,
but
every era
that,
has
those periods of invention when the industry is really growing and changing, it also tends to invite the entrepreneurs to say, I'm going to make a quick buck.
I think the cream floats to the top and the crap sinks to the bottom.
Yeah. Daniel Feit, you paid good money for this podcast. I want to hear what your
Dan,
3 years.
Been way too
and what was your first import, too? I'm curious.
Well, my first import actually was not till much, much later. I got my Dreamcast. I modded my Dreamcast in Chinatown, New York City.
It was a cream blast.
And then around about that same time is also when I got a Neo Geo for the first time off eBay.
Yes, or
Rich Kid.
Wow.
Alert. Ding, ding,
no,
ding, ding, ding.
eBay.
And this was 99.
This was already 21st century. So
all right, yeah, you're right.
21st century.
And eBay was new.
I had one
eBay was new, so things were kind of cheap. It's like, oh, I have this old video game I don't want. Here, just take. You know what I mean? That kind of stuff.
Yep.
So I didn't start importing until it was already maybe 2000, 2001. But then I was buying a lot of fighting game imports and just weird stuff I'd read about. I remember I bought some
like Karnov's Revenge. Yes.
What was the first? what was the first one? Very first one.
Who was your first?
I think it might have been.
What was her name?
Sorry, I keep pulling back. I think it might have been. Oh, maybe one of the King of Fighters ports to Dreamcast, because they were at that point they were porting Neo Geo games to Dreamcast, which were, aside from the fact they were cheaper, they were also adding new backgrounds to them and
adding new
characters.
And it was links to the Neo Geo Pocket Color.
Yeah, and we had that. I think me and my friends, we all had young with disposable income. We had we were buying all that crap. Yeah. So
right.
we were linking
things
together. They were
doing the PS4 Vita thing like 15 years early.
There was a special cable that connected your Dreamcast
to transparring.
But I would say as far as the golden age, to me, it's actually much closer to what Jeremy had in mind. I picked, thank you.
Word.
I picked 86, 87, 88, and in my mind it comes just after Super Mario Brothers for two reasons. One is I think Super Mario Brothers sort of kicked down the door. It's like this is what video games are sort of heading to now. Because the arcade games had come and arcade games had blown up. But then the Super Mario Bros. Came out. It's like, okay,
side
now we get this new game where you're walking to the side and you can sort of control your own pace. There's a timer. There's lives. It looks like an arcade game, but you still have this freedom. And then from that point, the 86, 87, 88, you've got all these developers creating for this new platform. And they're sort of – they're setting the rules, as Kat said. But they're also experimenting with what they can do. I mean, if you think about it, like 86 is Castlevania in Japan. And then the very next year, you have Castlevania 2 in Japan.
Totally different.
And Zelda 2. Well, all the 2s back then, the 2s were where they were
like you had to be
and
different.
And they're like, oh, wait, we fucked up. And then with 3, they went back and made the first.
That's exactly my point.
There were a couple big games.
That's why I feel it was so golden, because people
Zelda,
were like,
Mario.
They were taking
well,
chances
Mario
like
in America,
that. They were like,
Castlevania.
We've got this established hit. Not just do it again. Let's just take a different direction. Let's make it an open world game. Let's make we got this Mario Bros. 2 is it's going to be too hard for the Americans. Let's take this completely different game and put Mario in it,
right.
And it plays totally different. But what the hell? Let's throw it out there. And it was a fantastic game.
Yeah, it was.
And
amazing.
Also, I mean, not even just the good games. Okay, established bad game. Okay, Takeshi's Challenge. I don't know if we've talked about it
before.
Yeah. That's a game that for people that know, it's a game that was developed by this Japanese comedian. And it's
who
almost purposely
hated video games.
He hated video games.
It is a hateful game.
Right. It's purposely obtuse, but it's also full of wacky ideas that no one ever thought. You can walk around town. You can punch anyone you want to. You'll never figure out the rules unless you read the book ahead of time. I looked up it. This is amazing.
There's a karaoke scene.
Yeah, there's, yeah,
there's a karaoke you could sing into the microphone.
Don't you have to leave them down the line for two hours? There were a lot of
more detective-y, adventure-y type games that came out on the Famicom, that's a lot of which never came to America, but were semi-popular here.
So games about politics, the presidential races.
And it just the flip side of that is, I think also in that period, 86, 78, you still, it's almost like the Famicom, and I guess the Disk System too, was basically the only game in town at that point in Japan. So it was kind of before
PCs also.
Yeah, the PCs were
there.
But
there was a lot happening on PCs and arcades too.
Console. I'm just saying for the console space, you've got this sort of one system. It was sort of before the game console arms race that exploded at the beginning of the night. You know, the Genesis, and then you've got this buildup that basically. We're still there today. We've got these new consoles, new platforms. It's like those 3 years. That was the explosion. It was huge in Japan. It was huge in America. Recent Retronauts episode, you had the Nintendo Mania stuff. Mm-hmm. Like even Americans were like, "What do we do with all this?"
That was
stuff?
A little later, but.
But it was that sort of that 3 years. That's
much the same. That's a
big bang of video games.
I pretty much agree with you. I mean, the reason I said 85 was because I was taking a slightly broader view, and I was also looking to arcades and PCs, and there was a lot of stuff that happened in Japan in 1985. Like in the arcade, you had a lot of really cool games like Ghosts and Goblins. You had, you know, people like Falcom making really interesting games on PC.
Falcom were doing on PC back then with Sorcerian, and you know, it was really, really amazing.
Well, that era was like basically the third party boom happened, where all the great classic third parties, some of them who are still around today, first and foremost, it's hard to think about this back in the day because things have changed an awful lot. But there was an era when anything Konami put in a box, I had to have immediately because everything they made was amazing.
Capcom's blue boxes too.
Capcom was pretty good, but Konami was stellar.
Like it was like when they sent out those posters.
Gear up or gear lip if you read it. You know, the way I did, but yeah.
No. I'm talking about there was like early kind of in the silver box.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Like, Castlevania, Contra.
You could get like free posters.
Russian Attack.
I got the Castlevania poster.
Yes.
Yeah. They were phenomenal.
That was also good, and it all had this like consistency, and you looked at it and you said, I want that.
Well, 90% of it was airbrushed over Arnold Schwarzenegger.
That's right.
Stallone poses.
Some of it was airbrushed over like Frank Frazetta.
Escape from New York.
Did you say your first import, Mark? Did I miss that part?
Yeah, no, not yet.
I didn't. It was Sunsoft Batman for the Mega Drive.
$99 the back.
Very respectable choice.
It was. It was
all
from,
five
probably
level,
from Die
all
Hard
five levels of
game
that
fan. That was actually a really good game. Excellent game.
Really short though.
It was fairly short, but it was difficult, at least in the Japanese version. And
you're like a total Batman hater now. What was it back then that made you like want to get that game?
I didn't give a shit about Batman. It was the fact that it was a good game.
You love Bat Dance. Come on.
I did love some Bat Dance. No, it was that it was a good game. It was that it was a good game, and I was desperate for that. And then I think Strider was the next game. Yeah.
Can we just talk about that?
We did on depends when this is released. My first one was almost Castlevania 3 because there was a gap between the U.S. and Japan launches, I even had it pre-ordered. Like I called them up and I was like, I want to order this, and like they basically set it up, and then I called them back the next day because the next day my local Toys R Us got Super Mario 3 English.
I want the bad music,
which I already had, but I still couldn't resist. I was like, I gotta be the first kid in my class
to
have it.
People who don't know too, back then importing was usually a matter of seeing two screenshots and then paying about anywhere between $100 and $130
to like GameFan or Chips and Bits
to get
or
a game. That you then were not going to be able to sell to anyone, really.
And there was no guarantee you were even going to get it.
Huge shot in the dark, yeah.
These greasy dudes on the phone.
For every Sons of Batman, there was like a Magical Boy Hatto or like a lot of this other stuff.
The game's not bad.
It was not bad. It was basically Psycho Fox, though, like remade for the next system.
It became Decap Attack.
Right, exactly, yeah.
This is almost pre-internet, too. Like,
It was pre-internet.
See, I totally missed out on that era because I just didn't have the money to do that. Like, I could not have afforded to do that.
I'm an older guy, so I was. I just
Mark,
got my first job, and that's where all the money went.
Yeah, Mark got in, like, you know, I think I was right at the cusp, and I just missed, like, the key era. Like, I couldn't afford my own Genesis. I had to wait a couple years later. But, like, Mark, like, is the guy who, like, bought, like, Street Fighter 2 for Super Nintendo on import with, like, arcade sticks. Like, that is what I would have done had I had money.
Digging dirt, literally. Got $1,000 and spent it all on Street Fighter 2 for the Super Famicom and two arcade component joysticks.
Similar to me. Except I didn't go all in on the Street Fighter, but yeah, I was digging dirt for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Wow.
What?
And made a couple of $1,000 that summer, and yeah, wow. Super NES, Street Fighter 2, like I would drive to Toys R Us every day until that freaking expensive cartridge came in.
Yeah. And back in the day, there was no like release dates, and so Toys R Us just call your house.
It was just a mystery.
Yeah.
You'd get home and your mom would say, Toys R Us, call that games, and you'd be like, oh my
God. For the NES era, I actually had my aunt worked at Best Products. I don't know if you guys remember that department store. It was a department store. There you go. She worked in the warehouse department. And,
oh man.
So I would be like, hey, when you see these fell this off a video warehouse. Game, could you pick it up for me? So she got like she'd pick it off, you know, the line, and then buy it with her employee discount and pass the savings on to me.
Were you were you taking all the Super Mario 2s and all the Zelda 2s?
I only got one
from
of each.
Everyone else.
Zelda
you
2
bastard.
Chip shortage.
You
anybody
bastard.
Right
I bought one of each. There's
selling them for
to
a profit
around.
On the schoolyard. Any trench coat.
I say Zelda 2. Anybody who worked at the KB at the Staten Island Mall in 1987, all of 1987, probably got a phone call from me like every single day asking when Zelda 2 was coming out.
There were like 8 game shops in town, and I would call them at least twice a week asking about Zelda 2 for months.
Yep.
I would lie to my
Nintendo,
mother
because the Fun Club News was lying to us.
I would lie to my mother and say, I called Service Merchandise, and they said they have it. Can we go get it?
You waste service.
Old school.
That's how desperate I was.
Speaking of that
the
kind
last
of stuff,
resort.
I still remember, in walking into a Babbage's and actually seeing the box there that they had Zelda 2 in, and it like didn't seem real. It was like, no, this can't possibly be just sitting here for sale if anybody wants to just walk up and buy it, because it had been so long that it had been
impossible
to
find. I had a very similar experience. I spent a long time, and someone's sister's friend was able to get a copy of Super Mario Bros. 3. And then, like, we waited, then the deal fell through, and I remember crying when the deal fell through. And then one day, just in our local supermarket, our local suburban supermarket, there was a Super Mario Bros. 3 just sitting on the shelf. Like, what? It's in the soup. Like
somebody just left this here.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah. Like, oh, man.
Where you would find it.
It's a milk and eggs and Super Mario Bros. 3.
I had a similar story. Like, my mom gave me this big, long talk after I found it. Because I was jumping up and down screaming. She thought I was being kidnapped. And so we had this long talk on the car ride home, like, Kyle, in public, you can't do that. That scares your mom.
So Nintendo was evil enough to put Super Mario Bros. 3 in its PlayChoice 10 machines in America 6 months before it was available. So every Sunday when my sister was going to choir practice, my mom would drive me to Children's Palace, and I spent an hour playing
Children's Palace also.
Oh my God.
Or Child World. And like the dude who worked in the World Nintendo area came up to me after a few weeks. He's like, you know what? I have this game at home. I imported the trash. I was like, you do not. That's impossible. He's like, I already beat it. And then when the wizard came
that
out,
was me.
When the wizard came out in Video Armageddon, when the little retarded kid like gets a whistle.
We don't use that word anymore.
We don't use that word. I went directly afterwards to the PlayChoice 10 and knew where to get the whistle.
You went and saw the wizard like 15 times probably too.
On that guy afterwards, like, do you know about the whistle? Watch this.
Yeah, he's like, I already knew about that.
the PlayChoice 10 thing was kind of amazing. I remember. I think it was in junior high at the time, and some friends and I went to the local university, Texas Tech University. Their like rec room had a PlayChoice 10, and months ahead of that game, they got that Super Mario Brothers 3, and I saw some dude playing through Giant World,
and was like,
"What is happening?"
When I saw that, my mind,
I was freaking out.
Yeah. My first
it was
import,
such great marketing.
My first import was Final Fantasy V. It was very good choice. Yeah, it was 1994.
Crazy. Secretly Chris Kohler.
It was 1994, and I printed out a walkthrough from Square.net at my computer lab in college. I was a freshman.
That was probably Chris Kohler's walkthrough.
Probably Chris Kohler's walkthrough.
Or mine.
Or yours.
Whoa, you did one too?
Yeah, mine's like the number one on GameFAQs.
I think it was yours, probably, John.
Kohler's number two.
Oh, yeah. Man.
And that was my first import, and there you go.
That game, I loved the hell out of that game.
That was a fantastic
game. That was a really good year. Final Fantasy V, Super Metroid, like...
Oh,
Mark,
man.
Did you say what
Star Fox.
I can't remember.
What?
Oh, yeah, you did. Yeah. That was right there in your years. 1992-ish.
Yeah, it was around there.
Did anybody import Tobal No. 1 just to play the Final Fantasy VII demo? Like
I did.
Me?
Yeah.
Yes.
No,
here.
But I did import... What had the Final Fantasy VIII demo?
Brave and Musashi.
I imported that.
Yep.
Remember when I
played it at the local import shop.
I won't even go there. I'll just upset. No, remember when Final Fantasy was worth like buying another game to get its demo? Like those were the days.
Man, Lightning Returns is pretty great.
So I hear.
From what I've seen. Awesome. No, it's not. But anyway,
I will pay an extra $10 to have DLC to just make her someone else in that game and then play the game.
They announced the unit cost
much,
today.
You
give me a Brave Fencer Musashi DLC
pretty much
code.
Play in different costumes that make her like Locke or Ferris or, you know.
Oh, really?
No, they announced the unit costume today. So there you go. Final Fantasy X-3 right there.
Dress
anyway,
fierce.
Okay. Yes, that was a great time.
You know, we talk about all the innovation that was happening in the late 80s, going back to the original topic, but... Oh my God.
Oh God.
We talk about all the innovation that was happening in the late 80s, going back to the original topic, but you know, a lot of that was happening in the late 90s too. I mean, you look at what people were doing with the Saturn, in particular games like D, games that had condoms in the box. Yes. Mm. Or you look at...
What was that? Well, that was 3DO, actually. That was Short Warp, but anyway.
Yes, my apologies. But or even games like Final Fantasy VIII, which I will defend to my dying breath because that game...
You can defend the junction system? Really?
My game is broken as all hell.
I don't care.
It's so great.
I don't care.
It's
so fun. First of all, it's really fun.
You can exploit it so easily.
Yes, I know. That's great.
Final Fantasy VIII is my Dragon Quest V to John. It
pushed the envelope.
Did you know the PlayStation 2 can do that dancing in real time?
Okay, that was the first time. That was the first instance I can think of where a developer came straight out and said, yeah, we're making the game about love, and it's going to be a love story. And I was like, a love story in a video game?
They based the emotion engine on that scene. They were like, that is an emotional scene. Our system is going to be emotional.
That's right.
Exactly.
Emotion engine. I think one thing, though, lest we like look back on that era with too much purely rose-colored glasses, some shitty things about that era of Japanese games, this golden...
Which era are we talking about?
Late 80s, early 90s.
Okay.
10-inch controller cords. Systems that do not come with the AC freaking adapter
were sold
separately. Yeah, well, we're talking about
Japan. That was a tradition
they
carried all the way through the GameCube, as I discovered when I came to Japan.
Hey, the 3DS XL doesn't have one either in Japan.
Completely fucking nuts. But I mean, these cords, for people who never owned a Super Famicom or a Famicom, I mean, we're talking...
They were like 5 inches, maybe.
It was
like
made
if you're
for
lucky.
A small Japanese apartment.
It was made to be sitting on the floor in front of your TV
with a game console on your lap.
Yeah, it was completely nuts.
And I got my Duo. Like it's really like 3 feet if you're lucky.
That's right. Like, only one for that system. But I will say, I do think Super Famicom still like the color scheme and the controller, just the look of it, the overall. Kind of aesthetic is maybe still my favorite.
The mystique, too.
I was actually just talking about this with one of Shane's coworkers today about how the design of the Super Famicom is just absolutely immaculate.
Unparalleled.
And the controller.
It still holds up.
It's beautiful.
So sad.
It is beautiful.
It's like a Tonka truck or something. It's just tacky.
The Super Nintendo, I thought at the time, looked cool or fine, but now it's so dated, and the Super Famicom did not get dated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Every console should look like the Super Famicom. Why don't they?
Is there anybody here who's willing to make a case for any point in the 2000s, like say 2002 to 2004?
For Japan?
It's really hard.
I mean, that was kind of the last point Japan raw, really, really,
like
really mattered.
You can point to sort of the heyday of the DS and the Wii, and there was some good stuff happening there, but the problem is that once there was sort of this convergence between consoles and PCs, like American developers, Western developers... had this big advantage because they had been working with PCs and really mastering the ins and outs of these genres and the technologies.
Also middleware. And I'll say traditionally Japanese developers didn't share middleware. They didn't.
They still don't.
They don't.
Fox Engine for Kojima Productions was designed theoretically to be licensed. And now they're like, well, it would take a lot of upkeep for us to license it, so we might let some people within Konami use it, but really, we're just going to use it.
Although some sequels do iterate on the previous tech, sometimes you get a completely different engine, like Zelda 1 to Zelda 2. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's nothing shared between those games.
The 2000s were a dark age, I think, for Japan, but I think there is actually some light at the end of the tunnel. Like, I think if we were to go 15 years in the future, what I hope is going to be the case is we're going to look back and say, like, 2014-ish to, like, 2017 is when the indie boom actually finally... Because it's starting now.
It is.
It's not there yet, but it's absolutely bubbling up.
This has
up.
Been my takeaway from this year's TGS. I see people on maybe Wired or other publications being very gloomy about Japan and pointing out
negative cynical things.
Damn. Yes. Gloomy. Pointing some that cynical Kohler, things man. That are kind of maybe taken out of context. But beneath the surface of it all, there is, like, Japan is finally starting to really come around to the concept of independent development.
Yep.
You know, things like, I don't want to sound like a cheerleader here, but Mighty
No.
No,
please
nine
do. Please, cheerlead away.
I mean, it's making, you know, Japanese developers more aware of the existence of crowdfunding and just
totally.
The way business has been developing.
BitSummit,
in
too.
The West,
BitSummit was a big deal here as far as getting indie gamers out of, like,
and
the caves
because,
they've been in for the last 10 years.
I feel weird as a journalist because I'm connected to, like, you guys working on Mighty No. 9, to James Milky working on BitSummit. But I guess it's just because I work with awesome people.
But
I mean,
you.
There is like this sea change happening, and it's very similar to what's been happening in the West. And I think it might have more impact here because America is, you know, the West is so entrenched in AAA development, and because it's fallen so far off the rails in Japan, I think there might be more room for this kind of insurgent, you know, design philosophy and business philosophy to make more of an impact and become more of like a mainstream thing in the US.
And what's exciting is that it kind of levels the play field again, because mm-hmm. as we talked about in 2006, obviously, when AAA development and ballooning development budgets really took off, Japan couldn't keep up, right? And if you have indie development taking over here, suddenly that's not a barrier anymore. And you can have the Japanese being on equal terms with Western developers, and that's really exciting.
Yeah, that's what they do best, right? Is that they're, I mean, all the creative, crazy, you know, quirky, just new ideas, they didn't come necessarily from technology as they did from, you know, just basically being able to come up with cool stuff. And now that they're back on platforms that can just, you know, 2D games or just like simple games, but like coming out with the ideas first, it's where they can really shine.
Like Keita Takahashi is doing, he's like, you know, random crazy projects.
He's making games?
Yeah, oh, the fart game.
Oh, that's okay to Takahashi. Yeah. You know, I was just talking to Kat at the at Shibuya Station as we were trying to hustle to make this podcast on time, and there were just these crowds of people. I was like, I understand where Katamari Damacy came from. I just want to roll these people into a ball and get them the hell out of my way.
One of my most greatest memories of living in Japan is when I first moved here. The day I moved here was the day Katamari Damacy 1 came out. And I remember walking from Aoyama Ichome subway station. I tried to find Shibuya. I didn't know how to get there. And I finally found the station. And I come around the corner, and you see Shibuya Station in all its glory. And there's a gigantic Katamari Damacy poster. And I'll never forget that as long
You're
as
like,
I
it's
live.
It's a cow.
Ah, Japan. Yeah, I think, like, you know, I'm really excited about the future, though, as much as we're here to talk about the past, because I feel like it's going to bring back what made Japan great, and that's what I'm really excited about.
I think the dark ages are behind us at this point.
Yeah, I would like for Dan to speak, because you seem to have a different opinion.
Well, I just going back to, you mentioned the early 2000s, and to me, that was my first break from games. I had a 2 or 3 year period where I sort of stopped playing any new games. I felt like I had outgrown it, or I just felt more in tune with the games that I used to play. I spent hours listening to old game music. Like I was still into video games, but somehow the new ones had lost all their luster to me. And it wasn't until I think I got my DS in maybe 2006 where I started to say, "Oh, well, there's still games out there.
Feeling the magic XXXY."
I think it was between.
I think it was Ping Pals that did it.
New Super Mario Brothers, and just the general holding the thing and just getting back into that sensation again. So I don't know. I hope you're right about the indie games and it being a move. I just don't know if it's going to take off as quickly as we hope it will. I mean, I spent a lot of time today in the indie booth section of the TGS, which the fact there is an indie booth section at the TGS is fantastic news. But
it's a start.
It's also, I mean, it's a rough start. I mean, was anyone at the show today? I mean, the indie booth was in the main floor for the first two to the business days, but as of today, it was moved out to hall number 9.
Oh, yeah.
Next to the family corner and the cosplayers. So it was kind of like, I mean, even though it was the public day, I walked in there and there was no wait for anything. You just sort of walked right up and talked to people. And I mean, don't get me wrong. This will be, you know, right about this, but they were all excited to be there. A lot of them were enthusiastic about the future, but for now it's still very much a growing pains, and people don't you know. Right.
Well, the thing is, indie game at a convention, especially for public, is not, people are not going to go there to find indie games because they don't know their existence. But the thing is, that is where all the gems are going to come from. Like all the future classics, essentially, are going to grow out of those basically dudes in their garages making cool shit.
I mean, I don't want to be like tooting our horns too much, but it is incumbent on guys like you and me who are writing about these to discover them and say, wow, you guys need to know about this because this game is
Jeremy,
amazing.
There's a lot more than that. I mean, I think in Japan there's a divide between the doujin scene, which is like a hobbyist
scene. Actually, I talked about this with the guys at Nigoro yesterday.
Right. Oh, nice.
There's an event happening tomorrow with Playism is sponsoring. PlayStation here is helping to sponsor too, where they're getting together a lot of indie developers, doujin developers. Like Inafune is going to be there. Press are going to be there. I think, you know, that kind of event is showing that like there is something coalescing here.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, I talked to the guys at Nigoro about, you know, like they've just announced La Mulana 2, right, which is
exciting.
I can't wait to play it. But you know, I talked to them, and like, you know, they were kind of these early Japanese indie developers, and like between them and Studio Pixel, you know, Daisuke Maya, there just haven't been that many since then. It's only been, you know, just kind of in the past year or two that you've started to see that. But at the same time, there was this huge doujin scene. And it seems kind of weird that there's like this divide between the two, and I don't know. Like it's like they explained it because, you know, like, they're gamers, but Dojin comes more from the comics scene.
Right, yep,
and
right.
It's kind of like, you know, like Toho, those games are kind of spun off from comics and sort of animation characters.
Sure.
Yep.
And so they're approaching it from a different perspective. It's not about necessarily the games. It's about taking these worlds and characters and exploring them in lots of permutations.
Right. But they're the ones who have sort of been at the forefront, if you even want to call it a forefront. I mean, they're the ones who were like in little plastic bags when you went into stores in Akihabara and stuff. But now, thanks to the internet, thanks to things like BitSummit and everything else, and just the general, you know, rise of indie games in the West, I think the real indie development scene is going to grow and outgrow them, I think, in a big way, and just really kind of bubble up and make a big stink in Japan. So
Takumi Naramura is who I talked to, and
he's the guy who made La Mulana.
Yeah, and he said, you know, BitSummit was a revelation for them because they finally had a chance to sit down. Like, guys like him were able to sit down with guys in the doujin scene and realize we have a lot of common ground. Like,
yeah,
we're trying to do the same thing, even though we're coming from a different direction. And so, you know, he sees like a future of more collaboration, more sort of
great
simpatico between these two different groups of Japanese independent developers.
They also got to really see the media for the first time. They didn't really even weren't even aware that there was like these people overseas who are aware of the games they're making and are really interested in them.
Crazy
and stuff.
Toho fans in America, yeah. Like, people really are into that lore. I don't even begin to understand it, but there are plenty of people who do.
Maybe the next golden age when we meet again in 15 years.
That'd be great.
We'll be talking about...
I would be happy to look back and say 2013, man.
Yeah.
That was an amazing year.
Right? Me too.
All right. Well, thanks, guys. Dan, was there anything else you wanted to say? I feel you got to get your money's worth.
Well, no. It's honestly, I mean, there's so many people here tonight. This is really... I know now what Christian Laettner must have felt like in 1992 Dream Team, you know, walking on the court with Ewing and Magic and Larry Bird. Just like, I can't
compete.
Was
that a sports reference? I don't understand.
Right. It was a momentous occasion.
And Dan, that's when you graduated from University of Kentucky. If you'd even mention Christian Laettner, it's like a huge offense to me.
Likewise, as a Timberwolves fan, don't ever mention that name.
Never mention that.
Didn't know you were going to get all the static
guys,
from doing a
we got in trouble for talking about politics a few episodes ago.
Sports, religion, and politics.
At first, I thought he said Christian Slater, so I was in the 80s.
Hey, everyone. Anyway, Dan, you were saying?
No, I'm just no need to worry about what I need. I think if I wasn't as vocal as usual, I think it's largely agree. I mean, you almost nailed exactly what I felt was the golden age of gaming. I think we could. I don't know. I think we had a golden age. I think we had a silver age. Maybe there's a bronze age. But I don't know. I think one of the positives of a rising indie movement is that, in theory, a rising indie movement is essentially nationless. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, if you look at the indie area that was on the TGS floor, I mean, there were Japanese development, but there were also people from – I met a lot of people today
Vietnam.
From Taiwan.
Guy from Germany was there.
Yeah. I met two guys from Sweden. Who were there? And one of them.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
That was a different guy. No, there was a guy from France actually who was showing an Ouya game, and he was there with yes.
Was he very sad?
Like, even nowadays, we meet indies who are distributed development, where one guy might be in America, one guy could be in Japan, the other
right.
guy could be
exactly.
in Sweden. Like, that
full,
happens.
Full credit.
I mean, not to do this the cheerleading again, but I mean, that's exactly what Keiji Inafune was telling me
right.
yesterday. Like,
right.
my number 9 is very international.
Or Matsuno's new project as well.
Yes,
Brazil
exactly.
Full credit. The Swedish man I talked to today, one of them coined the term. He said he called it a Skype company. In that
right, right.
one of them lives in Stockholm, one of them lives in Tokyo, and they have a third guy who lives in Nashville who does all the music. And all their collaborations are mostly digital at this point, but they're all getting together and they're working on something. And it was a beautiful game. I can't wait to see more about it. I think it's coming to Vita and PS4.
What was it called? Oh, the one called
Pavilion.
Pavilion.
Yes.
Yeah, it's this cool like puzzle solving game with great 2D art. Yeah.
Right. It was a beautiful nice. Look at. Yes, absolutely.
Cool.
Made by three people on completely different sides of the globe.
Yeah.
You know?
There's a lot of that going on. I think it's super exciting for
the future. So I don't know. I've come away from this TGS. I was hoping that this show would be good for me and that, you know, I would like come across interesting things and there would just be a positive outcome. And I really feel like there's a lot to be, you know, to be happy about, as opposed to the past few TGSs where I go home and I'm just like,
last year especially.
Man, oh, last year was so bad.
Waiting for the sun.
And I thought it would be the new consoles that did it this year, but that's, I mean, those are important.
There's a light on the horizon.
But there is so much more happening, like bubbling under the surface, and I'm really excited to see it sort of, you know, come to realization.
Cool.
Anyway, so we need to wrap up Retronauts episode 10. Thanks everyone for listening. Thanks all of you guys for being here. Thanks for letting us use your
Thank you. Awesome. No, thanks for awesome. Having us. Yeah.
Anytime you guys are in town, absolutely.
So let's see. I gotta do the Bob Mackey spiel. Let's see. We're on Facebook as Retronauts. We're on Twitter as Retronauts. We're on YouTube as Retronauts, although we never use that. We are on Retronauts.com, where you can find all the episode notes and see. Like, if I splice any music into this, you can be like, what was that music? That was so great. And then you can look at the blog, and it's right there, retronauts.com.
Definitely more music. I was so sad you left out the music of the Ultima 4. I was
waiting for I'll never do that again. Tunes. Never do that again.
Hey,
that
will you ever, any chance of video Retronauts at any point?
Yeah, we're obligated to do some video Retronauts.
Okay, good. Right. Just have part of the Kickstarter.
Get the pieces in order, but those will happen too, yes.
Cool.
So anyway... And I'm Jeremy Parrish on Twitter. My name is GameSpite. And you are?
At Mark MacD.
Well, what's your name?
You Mark MacDonald.
Okay.
I'll figure that part out.
Shane Benhausen at ShaneWatch.
Cat Bailey at the_CatBot.
John Riccardi at JohnTV.
Kyle McClain at FarmBoyInJapan.
My name is Daniel Feit, so I'm at Fight Club, like my last name, FEITCLUB, Fight Club.
Right on. All right, thanks again, everyone, and hope you enjoyed this. Those of you listening at home, perhaps we'll revisit Japan again someday and talk about, you know,
please
the
do.
Past of 2013 and how amazing it was.
I've heard a rumor there may be another game show next year.
Oh, yeah. Oh. No kidding. How about that? Anyway, we'll be back again next week at the Retronauts Pocket episode. Stay tuned to your iTunes feed and also give us 5 stars on iTunes because it's really important. Anyway, thanks again. John A.
Yosh.